Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
If you're hearing this, you're probably already listening to BBC's award-winning news podcasts. But did you know that you can listen to them without ads? Get current affairs podcasts like Global News, Americast and The Global Story, plus other great BBC podcasts from history to comedy to true crime, all ad-free. Simply subscribe to BBC Podcast Premium on Apple Podcasts or listen to Amazon Music with a Prime membership. Spend less time on ads and more time with BBC Podcasts.
Hello, welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. My name's Ed Butler. On today's edition, Vice President Kamala Harris' latest plan for fixing the US economy. It was unveiled on Friday and it's attracting some unwanted criticism since then, even from former allies. Also in the show, why Nicaragua's president is closing so many of the country's civil society groups, and the freak storm off Sicily that may have claimed the life of one of Britain's leading tech entrepreneurs.
We saw a red flare and we found this life raft drifting with 15 people inside. Four people injured, three heavy injured.
More on that later in the show. First, though, this.
Palestine will be free!
Palestine will be free!
The sound of pro-Palestinian protesters who've been gathering in Chicago on Monday as the Democratic National Convention prepares to get underway in the city. The four-day event is going to see Kamala Harris formally confirmed as the party's presidential candidate. The protests have long been expected, but they won't help the hoped-for effect of a united and hopeful political celebration for the Democrats. President Biden is going to be on stage in just a couple of hours to deliver a keynote address. Before that, though, we've asked Tessa Weinberg, a reporter with Public Radio, WBEZ, in Chicago, to give us a sense of the mood in the city as the DNC kicks off.
Near the United Center Arena on Chicago's Near West Side, cars zip down the main streets from the nearby highway. A train rumbles overhead. Tall black panels of fencing line sidewalks, and paper notices tacked onto fences warn of parking restrictions as officials lock down on security. The United Center Arena will be the center of the action for the Democratic National Convention. It can seat more than 23,000 people, so it regularly hosts major events like concerts and Chicago Bulls and Blackhawks games. Mike Salvatore owns Froth, a coffee shop a few blocks away from the arena. He's used to the big events, but even the DNC doesn't compare.
This is definitely next level. I haven't seen anything like this.
Joe Biden stepping down from the race and Kamala Harris stepping up to run for president has injected a new energy into the convention and business.
I feel like now we can kind of anticipate, hey, this is going to be great for the businesses. There's people's energy, people want to see this, people coming in for this.
Salvatore is seizing on that by doubling up staff, renting out the bar for private parties. And his staff are even cracking some coconuts open.
Okay. We need a good solid surface for it to crack.
It's for a coconut-flavored cold brew to seize on the viral Kamala Harris meme that came out of a speech she gave last year.
My mother would give us a hard time sometimes and she would say to us, I don't know what's wrong with you young people. You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you.
Despite the excitement for the week of festivities, Salvatore still has questions about everything from parking to what protests may look like.
We don't have any answers. That's, you know, as many questions as we can handle, we still don't have any answers.
Manny Cope co-owns Lake Street Barbering nearby. He thinks the convention is going to be a big headache.
I'm not excited for it. We're just kind of, let's get through it, you know, make the best of it.
He's been trying to get as much info to prepare, even from cops who are clients that come in.
That's what my cop friend says. He comes in, he has a beard, and every couple weeks he has to shave it off because they're getting fitted for their gas mask.
Jerry White lives down the street from the United Center. He says the city recently repaved the streets and put up new lights. When he first learned the DNC was coming to town,
I was thinking about running out my apartment. But I didn't do that. It'll be a nuisance for a short time. It's okay. I'll deal with it.
Chicago officials have vowed it will be smooth sailing. But even they acknowledge there's a level of uncertainty out of their control. Here's Glenn Brooks with the Chicago Police Department during a community meeting.
The DNC is a cousin who comes every 4 to 5 years. We really don't know what to expect the next time our cousin comes into town.
Beyond the traffic, people will be anxiously watching how police respond to protests. Violent clashes with police are the defining images of Chicago's 1968 DNC. Fast forward to today, and the city is still paying millions of dollars in settlements to protesters from the 2020 protests after the police murder of George Floyd. Protest groups have sued the city over the route to march during the DNC. Those plans were still in flux a week before the event. One of the top issues for protesters is the war in Gaza. For months, pro-Palestinian organizers have marched through Chicago streets to call for a ceasefire and an end to U.S. military aid to Israel. Chicago received $75 million in federal funds for convention security, and nearly a quarter of that is slated for Chicago police staffing, according to budget documents. Chicago's top cop, Larry Snelling, says rioting won't be tolerated.
We're not going to allow you to riot. Protesting and rioting are two different things.
While some Chicagoans will be leaving town to avoid it all, back at Froth, the coffee shop, Moises Arroyo is fine-tuning the coconut cold brew special and hoping to get a special visitor during the convention.
Maybe Kamala comes by, you know, give her a pastry and a drink. That'd be awesome. You're hearing this Kamala come by.
That's Tessa Weinberg from WBEZ in Chicago reporting there. Well, a few days ago, I spoke to the Chicago mayor, Brandon Johnson. This was before the convention was even close to launch, of course. I asked why this city in particular had been chosen to host the event.
Chicago was the capital of the world. All of the most innovative, transformational moments in our world's history have come right through Chicago. From Carnegie to the Model T to quantum computing, you know, skyscrapers and the steel industry. So it just makes perfect sense for Chicago because the world economy is what it is today because of Chicago.
And now the DNC. I mean, they don't always come to Chicago, do they?
They don't. We've had the most conventions, though, in the history of America. There are more conventions on both sides of the political spectrum here in Chicago because we're really good at conventions. And so as this unique moment in our nation's history is upon us, and we will launch from the city of Chicago the first Black woman nominee in the history of America and the inevitable next president of these United States of America.
I'm glad you think it's inevitable, sir. I think there'll be those on the Republican side who don't. But nonetheless, I mean, what are the challenges you face in hosting an event like this?
You know, our responsibility is to make sure that everyday Chicagoans can still move about their day. One of the challenges that we've had to work hard to respond to is just making sure that as a result of this convention, that other resources would not be sacrificed. And we have not done that. In fact, we have continued to make sure that the everyday residents of the city of Chicago are fully engaged and supported.
You're expecting protests?
Of course I am. And we are prepared and we'll be ready for it. You know, look, you know, protests in this world have long been the catalyst for substantial transformation, not just in our country, but around the globe. You know, when you think about the protest of the South African apartheid system or the Jim Crow system here in America, when you think about the women's suffrage movement, these are everyday people who stood up to the government to challenge the government to do right by everyday people. And so my existence as a Black man, as mayor of the third largest city in America in one of the largest economies in the world, I do not exist without protest.
The other side of this, I guess, a big talking point in the election is the issue of crime, street crime, particularly in the bigger cities. Chicago has a reputation in the U.S. as being one of the crime capitals of the U.S., does it not? How do you, I mean, it does have that reputation, whether deserved or not. Do you feel that that is something that you're going to have to defend when it comes to this event?
Well, first of all, it's not true. We're not even in the top 20 in this country. Look, here's what I'm doing in Chicago. The safest cities in America and the safest cities around the globe, they all have one thing in common. They invest in people. You know, I'm a product of public accommodations, went to public schools, sent my children to public schools, rely upon public transportation. I needed public health because I grew up with asthma. I come from a working class family. And so as we address community safety, in this city, the way we should be addressing community safety around the globe is you invest in people.
What are your hopes for the DNC for this week of events?
My hope is that Chicago will be labeled based upon its true worth and value, that this was the city that launched a Black woman, a woman of Asian descent as well, to one of the most powerful spots in the world, and that it is seen through the lens of the diversity of our world, from Black, brown, white, Asian, young, old, that working people in this country will finally have a real say-so in the decisions of this great nation, and that poor people will no longer be unheard and unseen. Clearly, I have incredibly high expectations, but that's just who we are as a city.
Brandon Johnson, the Democrat mayor of Chicago, on his hopes for the Democratic National Convention. Well, to some more of the politics now, the specific politics. This comes just 3 days after Kamala Harris first really specified her economic proposals as part of her presidential bid. These include a tax credit for builders of homes sold to first-time buyers, as well as up to $25,000 in down payment assistance for eligible first-time buyers. She's called for caps on the monthly price of the diabetes drug insulin, finding ways to cancel medical debt and giving families a $6,000 tax credit the year they have a new child. Probably most eye-catching of all her plans, though, she wants to end the scourge of what she calls price gouging. This is the artificial escalation of prices by retailers, which she says has brought so much misery to many American families.
And I will work to pass the first ever federal ban on price gouging on food. My plan will include new penalties for opportunistic companies that exploit crises and break the rules, and we will support smaller food businesses that are trying to play by the rules and get ahead.
As Kamala Harris speaking last Friday, over the weekend, her opponent Donald Trump leapt on these ideas as more evidence that the vice president was a communist. Those were his words, communist instincts.
Who would believe this? 80 days from now, we are going to defeat a communist known as Kamala Harris. She's a communist. Most radical left person ever to run for office. This is not what this country needs. We've had enough of them. We're going to win back the White House, and we're going to take back our country.
Well, mainstream economists may not be speaking in such stark terms, but many do think the latest plans are populist. A bad approach to tackling the scourge, for instance, of high grocery bills. Professor Ken Rogoff at Harvard said, in his opinion, corporate price gouging hadn't all that much to do with inflation. Jason Furman, a former Obama economic advisor, called the proposals not sensible. Isabella Weber, she's an economist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst.
Let's face it, it's of course a complicated problem. Inflation is always a complicated problem, but the idea that we can fight inflation with one single tool, namely interest rate hikes, I think is very unrealistic. So it's clear that we need a number of tools to deal with the kind of profit-led, emergency-induced inflation that we have all been living through. And price gouging laws are an important tool in that toolbox. In the United States, many states already have price gouging laws. So this is not something that came out of thin air or that is the heritage of communism or worse. During the pandemic, Trump actually also issued an executive order on price gouging in the medical sector. So what this price gouging legislation would do is basically take this price gouging legislation to the federal level where it belongs, and she would address this to the food and grocery sector, because this is the sector where ordinary consumers, ordinary households are hit the hardest. In other words, the vulnerability of consumers to these price increases is particularly high in food. So I think she's laser focused on just the right sector here. And she's proposing to set clear rules for how much firms can increase prices and what would constitute excessive profits, so that the FTC and state attorneys could investigate and impose some strict penalties if companies actually went up against those rules.
Indeed. And food prices surged more than 20%, I believe, under the current administration. So many people are feeling the crunch when it comes to just their regular food bills. But it has been argued by many senior economists, hasn't it, that the existing state-level laws against price gouging have a lot of undesired effects. One of them is it motivates people to go out and buy more goods than they would if prices had risen. If you force them down, people buy more, and it adds, once again, to a supply crunch, which ultimately leads to more inflation.
So what we have seen in the pandemic is actually exactly the opposite. There was a toilet paper shortage. People panicked. And when people panic, then they start hoarding. And when they start hoarding, then they buy up stuff and then they can actually generate a shortage, right? So if you ensure people that these prices are not going to spiral out of control, that companies will not be in a position to increase prices in an excessive way, you can actually prevent this kind of panic. You can prevent this kind of hoarding behavior and thereby actually prevent these kind of shortages that can emerge in times of emergencies. We see that grocery sectors in most countries are extraordinarily concentrated. When there are situations of price gouging, we are not dealing with a perfect market. So we need regulation in order for prices not to overshoot, because these overshooting prices can be harmful for consumers and are also not necessary for the supply adjustment to take place.
The thoughts there of the economist Isabella Weber.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather, and there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.
World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Well, I'm joined now by Peter Jankowskis. He's the Vice President of Research and Analysis at Arbor Financial Services in Chicago. Hi, Peter. We've heard about price gouging there. There's more proposals today, aren't there, from the Democratic campaign. Vice President Harris is calling for raising the corporate tax rate to 28%. It's her first major proposal to raise revenues and finance expensive plans that she wants to pursue. How will the markets react to that, do you think?
Well, I think they'll take it with a grain of salt, recognizing that she's going to need support from a Democratic-controlled Senate and House in order to pass that. It's unlikely, if the Republicans retain the House and or capture the Senate, that any of that would go through. So I'd expect reaction to be somewhat muted. The other thing that I would add is that it's a somewhat more moderate view that she expressed when she was running for president in 2020. At that time, she was calling to raise the corporate tax rate to 35%. So in some ways, she's signaling some moderation. But overall, it doesn't seem like a good policy to me.
Okay. But what I guess what politicians say and what they do is seen in two different lights right now. Let's just return to what's happened today. The dollar fell to a seven-month low. The Japanese yen hit more than 1 week high. I mean, what's going on here?
Well, there may be a continuation of the sentiment that the Fed will be lowering the federal funds rate next month, which would certainly cause people to shift capital out of the United States. Potentially. So that could be somewhat reflected in that number.
And investors, meanwhile, are still piling back into equities. It feels like a full recovery, does it? To what
it
we
does,
saw a
it does. I think, we're seeing strong gains among the highly interest rate sensitive areas of technology, communication services. So all of this is, again, related to speculation on what the Federal Reserve is going to do next month.
Peter Jankowskis, thank you very much indeed. Now, the government in Nicaragua has outlawed 1,500 civil society groups in the last few hours, the biggest such ban in a single day. They're accused accused of failing to report their finances and face the confiscation of all their property, according to the government. Most of the groups are religious, but they also include sports clubs and educational and business associations. The government says the NGOs have not complied with the 2020 requirement to register them as foreign agents. Juan Sebastian Chamorro is an economist and a former presidential candidate himself, who is now in exile. I asked him why all of this was happening today.
My explanation of what is behind this is that the Ortega regime is trying to erase all NGOs, regardless of their orientation. They have eliminated charities, evangelical churches, the Red Cross, cultural organizations, sports club, livestock competition organizations. So there's now very little NGOs that have survived, probably the ones close to them. So basically, what's behind that is to erase completely the landscape of NGOs. Last week, they actually announced that they were going to work in a different way with NGOs, in which they will eliminate tax exemptions, for example, and that they have to be some kind of partners of the government.
But yeah, I mean, the government says that the organizations are canceled because they haven't complied with the requirement to register themselves as foreign agents, that kind of thing. I mean, is that not an acceptable argument?
Absolutely not. Just to give you an example, the NGO that I had, we have to present every year the new board of directors, for example. We have to inform the Ministry of the Interior, the new board of directors. The Ministry of Interior never accepted our letters announcing that change. So basically, by closing the window, they are using the excuse of not fulfilling with the requirements, but they are just inventing the argument in order to confiscate all the assets that this organization has. You think that
there's an economic reason here?
Absolutely, absolutely. The government is in a current crisis with its social security system. And just imagine 1,500 organizations, they own houses, temples, office buildings, bank accounts, historical buildings. So all these things are going to be passed to the government through this decree that was announced this week.
So it's a crude asset grab. That's your argument.
Yes. And also by eliminating tax exemptions, the existing NGO, which I doubt will be some, or the new NGOs will have to pay taxes. And taxpayers will not be able to donate part of the money to NGOs as well. So there is a fiscal constraint here behind the decision, but there's also a political reason. They want to have absolute control of everything. As a reminder of who are listening to us, there's no independent media in Nicaragua. There's no TV channels and there's no newspapers, and there will be no NGOs from today on.
The government has said that many NGOs are simply fronts for seditious organizations, those determined to bring the government down.
That's the same argument Vladimir Putin said a couple of years ago, and Ortega copied the legislation, the Russian legislation, and is arguing the same thing, as well as right now, Nicolas Maduro is just passing legislation in the Venezuelan National Assembly to do the same.
How would you characterize the state of the Nicaraguan economy right now?
It's surviving by family remittances sent from Europe and especially from the United States and Costa Rica. More than 14% of the entire population have left the country due to the crisis that erupted in 2018. Ortega has promoted this exodus of people, so more than 700,000 people have left the country. Now they're sending money back to the economy, and consumption is maintained, so to speak, because of this huge influx of remittances. About 10 years ago, remittances were about 12% of GDP. Today is 29% of GDP.
So basically, all of its foreign income is coming in the form of relatives sending money back to their loved ones.
Yes, there are also some exports that account for foreign exchange, but remittances have increased a lot. But at the end, this exodus of people is a huge cost for the Nicaraguan economy because you're basically depleting your human capital. And that's, as you know, the basic tool for an economy to grow in the long run.
The former Nicaraguan presidential candidate and economist Juan Sebastian Chamorro. The search continues into the night off Sicily for six people missing after a super yacht sank there in a freak storm. The British tech entrepreneur Mike Lynch is among those missing, along with his 18-year-old daughter. One body has already been found. I asked the BBC's international business correspondent Theo Leggett about what else we know.
Well, this looks like a very unfortunate incident, Ed, and a very unlucky one for those involved. What seems to have happened is that in the early hours of this morning, a luxury yacht, a 56-metre yacht called the Bajan, was moored up outside a harbour near Palermo when a sudden and very dramatic storm hit. As a result of that, the boat sank. It was carrying 22 people. We know that one man has died. Six are still missing, including the British entrepreneur Mike Lynch. Others, though, were rescued, including his wife. And the captain of a nearby ship says he found 15 people in a life draft. His name's Carsten Berner. Here's what he had to say.
We saw a red flare. So my first mate and I went to the position and we found this life raft drifting with 15 people inside. Four people injured, three heavy injured, and we brought them to our ship.
Many people still missing, Mike Lynch among them, the software millionaire. Tell us more about what we know about Mike Lynch, a colourful figure who was obviously had been in the news in recent years.
Definitely a colourful figure, Ed, and one who was once described as Britain's answer to Bill Gates. He went on to set up a number of companies, including one called Autonomy. And Autonomy basically provided data management and search software for companies. Hewlett-Packard, the American giant, came calling, decided it wanted to buy Autonomy, made an offer that Mike Lynch and his co-founders couldn't really refuse, and which valued the company at $11 billion. Not long afterwards, in fact, little over a year afterwards, that deal went very, very sour indeed, and Hewlett-Packard wrote down the value of the company by something like $9 billion and accused Autonomy of accounting irregularities, basically saying that prior to the merger, the figures had been fixed to make the company look more profitable and in a better financial position than it was. That sparked off a whole wave of legal action. And ultimately, in 2018, the Department of Justice came calling. In the end, the jury listened to his arguments and those of his lawyers and decided to acquit him. And that was just a couple of months ago. He did an interview for the BBC not that long ago when he said it was only because of his wealth that he was able to successfully fight his case in the American system.
The US court will not extradite someone without testing out the facts first. You're taken from your home in England, you're put in chains, you're put on an aeroplane, you may well end up, even before your trial, spending 2 years. You will not have the funds to put on a defence, and you will plead. The reason I'm sitting here, let's be honest, is not only because it was ultra-innocent, but because I had enough money.
The words of Mike Lynch there, who's today missing off Sicily. The BBC's Theo Leggett ending this edition of World Business Report. Thanks very much for listening.
You've heard of Charlie Chaplin, right? Well, Charlie Chaplin was my grandfather. And there was a time when he was the biggest star in all the world. But something happened, not just to him, but to hundreds of artists in Hollywood. They were forced to leave, forced out.
All episodes of Hollywood Exiles from the BBC World Service and CBC are available now. Search for Hollywood Exiles wherever you get your podcasts.